visit www.financialrepressionauthority.com for more information and make reference to the Roundtable Insight for applicable discounts on products and services.
Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment. Now, here's your host, hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Welcome back to the second episode of the FRA Roundtable. I'm Eric Townsend. I'm a hedge fund manager with Fourth Turning Capital Management. I also host the Macro Voices podcast, which is published at macrovoices.com every Thursday evening. Great panel we've got today. Alastair MacLeod is head of research for Gold Money, and he's an Austrian economist. He has a background as a stockbroker, banker, and fund manager. Ronald Sterfeli is a managing partner and investment manager at Incrementum AG. Together with Mark Valick, he manages a global macro fund, which is based on the principles of Austrian School of Economics. Peter Buchvar is the chief market analyst with the Lindsay Group and the co-chief investment officer with Buchvar Advisors. We're going to start with a topic that's on everyone's mind this week, which is the debate having just occurred in the U.S. presidential race. I've asked each of our panelists, without expressing their own personal views on politics, to comment objectively. What would the impact of either a Trump or a Clinton presidency be on global markets? Why don't we start with Alastair MacLeod?
This is a fascinating one because what Donald Trump has done so far is he's managed to appeal to the disaffected American voters. And that, I think, is one task. So he has been a very clever Machiavellian, if you like, in the Democratic context. Now, this is a completely different thing from actually being president. You can say whatever you want to get people to vote for you, but the reality of office is very, very different. So actually, I think we've got very little clue as to how he will perform if he is elected president. I understand the electoral system actually works against the possibility of him being elected president. I don't understand enough about the American system, but from what I have read, it still seems to be an outside chance, even though he now appears to be in the lead in the polls. But I would make the point that what politicians say to get elected is not the same as what they actually do when they're elected.
Ron Sterfeli, what's your view?
I think that Donald Trump has the possibility that he will win the election is much higher than the media and all those polls and so on discount. So from my point of view, I think he will make it. One of the reasons is I just attended a conference in the U.S., the Precious Metal Summit. I really talked to a lot of people, waiters, concierges at the hotel, CEOs of gold mining companies, really, really very, very diverse set of people. And they all said that they're going to vote for Trump. They all said that they are disgusted with the political establishment and that they want change. A bit similar like in a relationship that just doesn't work. At some point, you have to file for a divorce, but you don't know if it's going to be better or worse afterwards, but you just have to change something. So from my point of view, he will make it. I mean, his slogan, Make America Great Again, is just fantastic. And I think that, we actually wrote about that in our last In Gold We Trust report. And I think the fact that he is that popular, it clearly shows that the U.S. economy is doing much, much worse than the official data shows. From my point of view, the U.S. is or will be in a recession very, very soon. And as we know, it's the economy, stupid. And I think that Donald Trump for financial markets might be some sort of a catalyst. I think that financial markets would react very, very nervously about the election. And I think it's one of his main kind of strategies, and he confirmed that quite often, is that the dollar is too strong. So he would try everything to devalue the dollar, and that should be pretty positive for gold and the commodity space.
And Peter Buchfar, what's your take?
Well, as a follow-up to that, I think regardless of who the next president is, in the early part of their term, they're going to preside over a recession, a bear market, and rising debts and deficits. So we can all discuss what's the market going to do the day after, but they're both going to face the same challenges. The question is how do they deal with that? And if you looked at just the plans, and you didn't have Donald Trump above plan A, and you didn't have Hillary's name above plan B, and it was just plan A, plan B, well, plan A with Trump, you'd see, okay, trade wars, that's a big negative. But then you would see potential easing of the regulatory noose that's been choking business over the past 8 years. You'd see potential tax cuts. That would be good. So you have one big negative and maybe two positives. Then you look on the other side where, yes, it would be a continuation of the past 8 years, but that has not necessarily been very conducive for economic growth. I think bottom line is, as I said, both will face the same challenges regardless of who wins. And central banks have manhandled markets over the past 8 years. So to think that who the next president is going to be the deciding factor, it's not. It's still going to be central banks.
I couldn't agree more with that. This is Eric Townsend. I'll add my own view on the end of this, which is I think Donald Trump has really boxed himself into a corner and has a problem now. And the reason is, although I happen to personally agree with his very strong criticism of Janet Yellen and the Fed for essentially propping up markets in order to create wealth effect, which is creating a bubble, I agree with that criticism. But what he's done is he's set up a situation where as soon as it looks like he might get elected in the polls, markets are going to think that the punch bowl is being taken away because he's been so critical of the Fed. And even as much as I agree with him, if the market starts to tank, that's not going to help him. And you better believe if there is a politician on earth who knows how to spin that in her favor, it's Hillary Clinton, who will just say, look, the markets, every time Trump surges in the polls, the markets start to crash. The market's telling you that this guy is bad for the stock market. Now, of course, what the market would really be telling you is that if Hillary is elected, it's status quo and the government and government policy is still for sale to Wall Street through bribe money in the form of political campaign contributions. So I don't think that it really means that it's good for the world if Hillary is president. But boy, she's got an opportunity to spin this, and I think she's going to do it. Let's move on, though, from there to Fed policy, since Mr. Trump was so critical of them. I'd like for all of our panelists to comment just on what you see going forward. So many people, whether it's Donald Trump in this electoral debate, or so many smart people, whether it be Ray Dalio or Jeff Gundluck or a number of other hedge fund managers, have just said, look, the credit cycle's over. This central bank-funded liquidity bubble has gone as far as it can go. We're ready for a whole ugly mess to happen next. Are these people onto something? Are we really headed for a major bear market? Or can central banks continue to prop things up with money conjured out of thin air for a few more years? Why don't we start again with Alistair MacLeod?
I think the answer to this one is that increasingly what the central banks are doing is they're trying to stop a bear market in bonds materializing. Now, this is very, very important because if you look at particularly the European bank, some of them are very highly geared and they are overloaded with sovereign debt on their balance sheets. If you get a substantial bear market in sovereign debt, those banks basically go under. I think that all the central bankers seem to be pursuing an absolutely ridiculous, unjustifiable monetary policy in any other terms. But if you think in terms of they have got to stop a bond bear market and maybe just sort of have a period of stability, then I think that probably explains a lot about current monetary policy. But the thing that does worry me about current monetary policy is that I do think next year, 2017, is going to see an acceleration in price inflation, even measured by underreporting CPI statistics, to the point where the Fed and the other central banks, particularly the Bank of England, and it may not appear to be likely, but also the ECB, are going to have to raise interest rates in order to control the inflation monster. But they cannot do that without breaking the system. So I can see that, I think I can see the reason why they're pursuing this ridiculous policy. But equally, I think it tells us that there is no way out. They have got to the end point, and we're likely to discover that, I would expect, over the next 9 months to a year.
Ron Sterfeli, what's your take?
Very good point that Alistair brought up. I think that inflation, and by that I mean price inflation, not monetary inflation, but price inflation will definitely become quite a concern going forward. And there's a significant amount of data that confirms this view. First of all, we've got the price of gold rising in basically every currency now. I think gold is a very, very good thermostat or signal regarding future price inflation. There's the sticky price CPI, for example, being on the highest level since 2008. Our own proprietary inflation model signals since March rising inflation. And basically, this is exactly what central bankers always wanted. They want rising price inflation, but their hubris is basically that they will be able to control inflation dynamics. And I'm very critical of those models. And I think price inflation might become for example, in 2011. Most people forget that in 2011, late summer, early fall in the US, we had CPI rates at 4.5%. That was pretty significant. And we should not forget that last year, at this time of the year, oil prices started to collapse. And therefore, the base effect will be kicking in the next few months. And therefore, I think that price inflation will become the big pain trade for financial markets. And this is probably the catalyst for some sort of a crash on bond markets.
And Peter Buchfar.
Well, I'm going to add to that because I agree completely with what was just said, because you're going to combine in the U.S. services inflation ex energy, which is running 3% year over year, with a bottoming in commodity prices where, yes, the rate of change now with gasoline in particular is now zero. So just by rate of change, headline inflation is going to head up. But I'm going to combine that with a couple of other things. I think the canary in the global bond market was Japan, where 2 months ago, the 40-year JGB yield touched 7 basis points. Within 2 months, that yield was 67 basis points. As the Bank of Japan implicitly acknowledged, up until last week when they were explicitly acknowledged, that they were doing major damage to their banking system and therefore needed a steeper yield curve. So they started buying less JGBs. And then we get into last week this whole yield curve control. Well, since the meeting, the yield curve control has actually somewhat backfired because the 10-year yield has gotten further away from zero, and a yield curve of minus 10 basis points to zero is not really steep. So it was the first sign that here's a central bank acknowledging the limits of their policy and a bond market that's somewhat fighting against that. Then we have the ECB press conference of a few weeks ago where Mario Draghi implicitly acknowledging that he's running up against his own limits. So to me, this is the beginning of the end of, or I should say, this is the end of the bond bull market potentially, and that the mid-July lows in yields we may never see again. So then you add the inflation picture potentially, you know, of oil up $2. Imagine if oil goes to 50 or 60 on these OPEC cuts. Imagine what headline inflation numbers are going to do. Also, with respect to U.S. Treasuries, foreigners have been net sellers of U.S. notes and bonds year to date, on an unprecedented scale. They've sold about $160 to $170 billion of notes and bonds. So to me, this is all combining for a possible mix that's going to be negative for global bond markets, which would then be negative for any asset that's priced off low interest rates, particularly equities. And this is not necessarily an event, but I think a process that really got underway in Japan and is now going to gain some legs.
And this is Eric Townsend. I very much agree with everything that each of you has just said. What I'll add is my prediction for several years now has been this supporting of asset markets with printed money is going to continue, because when you give central bankers the authority to conjure money out of thin air at the push of the button, they're going to use that authority until something ties their hands.
So bond market and the banking systems in Japan and Europe are beginning to tie their hands.
And that's precisely my point, is what I've predicted for years now is until we have real signs of inflation, they're going to keep getting away with this, and they're going to make the eventual crash bigger and bigger and bigger through this reckless action. But they're going to keep on doing it. Eventually, runaway inflation will tie their hands. And I think, as you say, we're seeing the earliest signs of that already. I want to give the other panelists a chance, though. We started on monetary policy, to comment on your views on the bond market, because that's where I was headed next with this interview. So let's go back to Alistair. What's your view? The notion that the 35-year bull market in bonds might be over, and we may have seen the final low in yields. Do you agree with that view, and what's your outlook, Alistair?
Yes, I would agree with that, and I'd like to add something which actually ties the previous topic in with this topic, and that is, I'm sure we've all noticed that US dollar LIBOR has been ticking up and is now currently, I think, about the 3 month is about 0.83, something like that, 8.4, 8.5%. Now, that is well above the Fed's rates. So that, what's that? That's telling me is that, if you like, the money market rates are above where the Fed is setting rates. So there is, if you like, a sort of a backwardation of sorts in the market. Now, the excuse for this, we are told, is because of upcoming changes next month in the way money market funds operate, which is going to discourage them from prime lending and encourage them to move towards lending to the government. But that's absolutely fine. But it does seem to me that there is more strength in LIBOR than that rather simple regulatory excuse would really justify. I tie that in with something else. If you take M2 and subtract from it M1, that gives us what I would term a very rough indicator of bank lending. Now, that has been increasing at above trend for all this year. And the last count that I had on this, it was tending to accelerate a bit more. So if you look at the LIBOR rate and you tie it in with the increase in bank lending, admittedly not the official figures, but looking at M2 minus M1, that does tell me that interest rates should rise. The Fed should raise interest rates and raise them very, very soon. For some reason, they're not doing it. But I think the market as a whole will begin to understand that actually the rate that matters is the free market rate measured by LIBOR, rather than the Fed funds rate. So this, again, I think feeds into the risk that we have seen the top, if you like, in bond prices, the bottom in yields. And yields in bond prices are likely to increase. And importantly, this is a situation which I think LIBOR is telling us is getting increasingly beyond the Fed's control, which is a very interesting point to absorb. Now, if I'm right in that, then the potential downside in the bond market is actually quite enormous. And particularly if you look at the sovereign debt in Europe, I mean, who the hell would lend money to Italy for 10 years at 1.5% or 1.75%? I mean, it's just completely mispriced. So we've got highly mispriced bond markets. We have got a few sort of monetary early indicators indicating that all is not well. I think the potential for a bond market crash is actually very, very large. And that's the next thing that the central banks are going to have to try and prevent.
Ron Sterfele, what's your take? Is the low print in for Treasury yields?
You know, from a relative point of view, 10-year treasuries at 1.5% are great value compared to European yields, for example. I mean, the 10-year bond futures are at 165 at the moment, and you know, from managing funds over here in Europe, it's really tough. And as I said, on a relative basis, U.S. bonds look pretty attractive. I think we should not forget, although I'm definitely in the inflation camp, we should not forget there's also quite a lot of deflationary risk in the markets. Just have a look at the stock chart of Deutsche Bank, for example. Have a look at their CDS. So a banking crisis, something similar to 2008, would definitely be deflationary. And Janet Yellen, I think it was just a footnote from her speech in Jackson Hole. She kind of said that pretty dramatic negative rates would have been the right choice in 2008. So if the U.S. should also implement negative rates sooner or later, I think this crazy 35-year bull market in bonds could even accelerate. But you know, it's just tough making forecasts on a trend reversal on a 35 year bull market. I think a top is a process, and we're really close to the top. So from a longer term perspective, of course, there's no value, but I cannot rule out that yields will go even lower.
And this is Eric Townsend. I very much agree. And the way I see this, we're in the ninth inning for sure in this thing. But we're also seeing a lot of recession signals right now. And if we fall into recession, it's entirely possible that we could see even lower yields before this is over. But I definitely think we're getting close to the end game. If given the other panelists two opportunities to respond on these topics of Fed policy and global bond market, I want to give Peter Buchvar the last word on that topic before we move on. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I want to just add something to what I said earlier. I think the game of negative interest rates is over. Kuroda acknowledged he can't go deeper into negative interest rates because of what he's doing to his banking system. I mean, the Topix Bank Index fell 50% over the past year from high to low. The European Bank Stock Index fell 50% from high to low. The negative interest rate game is over. Now, I'm not saying the Bank of Japan is going to reverse it anytime soon or the ECB, but I think it's proven to be awful policy that they'll be certainly embarrassed to quickly backtrack on, but I don't see them going any deeper. And I see zero chance that the U.S. goes to negative interest rates. I think for that reason, I think there would be bills in Congress so fast to fire Janet Yellen and every single Fed member that pushes negative interest rates. You'd have marches on the Eccles building. You'd have the AARP walking down Pennsylvania Avenue. So the political heat on negative, and you'd blow up the U.S. money market industry. So yeah. I don't think that that's happening. I think that is a major inflection point also for global bond markets, because we know the only reason why you buy a negative yielding instrument, which essentially is not an asset, it's a liability, is because you're hoping to flip it to some other schmo. If that game is up, then buying negative yielding bonds becomes a much more dangerous game.
I couldn't agree with
very good points. Yeah, very good points, Peter.
Let's move on now to a topic that I know is near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts, and that is both gold and mining shares. And I'd like to ask each of you to comment. I think there's a growing view that gold's, at least short-term bear market, has probably ended, and we're at least in a bottoming process, if not the bottom is in and we're headed higher from here. But a topic that's on a lot of investors' minds is bullion versus mining shares. What's the smarter investment? Let's start again with Alistair MacLeod.
Well, I think it depends what you want out of gold. If you regard gold as if you like, insurance against the system falling over, or if you regard it as money, which of course is what it always has been, then owning gold mines is a different matter. It is completely different. It is a speculation. It's a speculation that could be very, very profitable, of course. And I think it's also worth mentioning that circumstances where gold ownership is banned, it's very hard for a government to stop you buying gold shares. So, it depends very much on the circumstances. I think home state mining traded extremely well after 1933 for obvious reasons. I love gold shares. I think it's a sector which has got so much to offer. It gives me an awful lot of enjoyment as a stockbroker, finding interesting gold mines, gold shares to invest in, different areas, different methodologies and all the rest of it. I mean, in my days, it was all South African gold shares. And so I really do appreciate how much fun that business is. And people like Rick Rule are past masters. I mean, they eat and sleep gold mines. So they really know what they're doing in that market. They know everybody. They know the management, all the rest of it. Which brings me back, actually, to an important point, and that is that anyone investing in gold mines has to understand that there are risks inherent in investing in gold mines which you don't actually have in bullion itself. Appreciate that, value the risk, and then you have a basis on dealing.
And Ron Sterfeli, what's your view?
Yeah, I just attended the Precious Metal Summit in Beaver Creek, and I think the overall sentiment is quite positive. I mean, it's not like the big party in 2011. I think the companies really learned their lessons. There's been definitely quite an enormous amount of creative destruction within the mining sector. I think CEOs were replaced. The focus has shifted to free cash flow and a really strong commitment to shareholder value, cost discipline, cost transparency. Many projects have been written off. Reserves grades have been raised. So I think that really the whole bear market was pretty positive for a sector that did not really deliver any leverage on a rising gold price. Only 2 or 3 years mining stocks really outperformed gold. So I think that the whole sector has been destroying capital within this gold bull market, and I really hope that they learned their lessons. So from a valuation point of view, I think it's a very interesting sector. In our last report, we had one chart where we showed the bull markets in the Barron's Gold Mining Index, and if our assumption is right that we're in a new bull market in gold, then this upleg in mining stocks will be only the beginning of the party. So I think from a risk reward perspective, it's interesting. It's a highly volatile sector, so I'm not sure if it's really suitable for every investor. You have to live with this volatility. You have to live with enormous political risk. But I think, as I've said, it's still quite a contrarian sector, and I just like mining stocks at the moment.
And Peter Buchfar.
I agree with what was just said, but just want to add that mining is a very difficult business. It's a terrible business. But I think mining companies have gotten religion over the past couple of years in terms of their balance sheets and their focus on free cash flow. So I believe also that the gold bull market ended in December of last year, and the new bull market has resumed. Therefore, gold companies, at least in the beginning part of the bull market, should way outperform the underlying. But as this bull market matures and prices get much higher, I'd be probably selling my gold miners and switching back into the gold bullion. Again, because mining is a very difficult business, there's will always be challenges no matter where the underlying price is, as seen over the past many years. But at least for now, certainly miners should outperform the underlying.
And I'm Eric Townsend. I'll just add that from my perspective, the trade that is just so appealing to me right now is a little bit sophisticated, but for our professional traders in the audience, long gold bullion futures and long dollar index at the same time. Obviously, that's normally a inversely correlated to assets. You wouldn't normally trade them as a pairs trade. But I can describe a macro argument for a home run there where both the dollar index and gold rally at the same time. I can describe scenarios where I got that wrong and one's up and the other's down, in which case it's a perfect hedge. But boy, the scenario where they both trend down at the same time, it just seems next to impossible to me. So I see a tremendous asymmetry of return in that particular trade. And unfortunately, on that note, we are out of time. I know that many of our listeners are very interested to follow the work of our panelists. So let's give you a little bit more perspective on who they are and where you can follow their work. Alistair McLeod, tell us where our listeners can get more information about what you do.
I write for Gold Money, obviously. So if you go to goldmoney.com and click on the Wealth button, under Wealth, you will find all the research. And I write an insight piece once a week. And I also write a market report on Friday mornings. So that's the extent of my output.
Ron Sterfeli.
Incrementum.li is our webpage. LI stands for Liechtenstein. Our company is based in the beautiful country in the center of Europe, basically, from my point of view, the safest jurisdiction in Europe. We're publishing the annual In Gold We Trust report, like 150 pages on gold, inflation, deflation, mining stocks, and so on, all based on our view, based on the Austrian School of Economics. And we also wrote a book called Austrian School for Investors, Austrian Investing Between Inflation and Deflation. So we are not only from Austria, but we're also very much adhere to the Austrian School of Economics.
And Peter Buchvar.
I have one foot on both sides of the fence. The sell side business as the chief market analyst for the Lindsay Group. You can see us at thelindsaygroup.com. Larry Lindsay was an ex-Federal Reserve governor and senior White House advisor. And then the other business is Bookmark Advisors, which is an investment management company where we manage assets of individuals and institutions. And you can see our website at bookmarkadvisors.com.
And finally, I host the Macro Voices podcast, which is published every week on Thursday evenings at macrovoices.com. That concludes this week's show. Please tune in every week for more interesting panels. For Financial Repression Authority, I'm Eric Townsend.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.